supported by a nationwide party and with some superior title to the crown. Anyone who studies the argument which now tore the realm will see how easily honest men could convince themselves of either cause. When King Henry VI realized that his right to the throne was impugned, he was mildly astonished. "Since my cradle for 40 years," he said, "I have been king. My father was king. His father was king. You have all sworn fealty to me on many occasions, as your father swore it to my father." But the other side declared that oaths not based on truth were void, that wrong must be righted, that successful usurpation gained no sanctity by time, that the foundation of the monarchy could only rest upon law and justice, that to recognize a dynasty of interlopers was to invite rebellion whenever occasion served, and thus dissolve the very frame of English society. And, finally, that if expediency were to rule, who could compare the wretched half-wit king, under whom all was going to ruin, with a prince who had proved himself a soldier and a statesman of the highest temper and quality? All England was divided between these two conceptions. Although the Yorkists predominated in the rich south, and the Lancastrians were supreme in the warlike north, there were many interlacements and overlaps. While the townsfolk and the mass of the people upon the whole abstained from active warfare in this struggle of the upper classes and their armed retainers, and some thought the fewer nobles the better, their own opinion was also profoundly divided. They venerated the piety and goodness of the king. They also admired the virtues and moderation of the Duke of York. The attitude and feeling of the public, in all parts and at all times, weighed heavily with both contending factions. Thus Europe witnessed the amazing spectacle of nearly 30 years of ferocious war, conducted with hardly the sack of a single town, and with the mass of the common people little affected, and the functions of local government very largely maintained. In 1450, the ferment of discontent and rivalries drew the Duke of York into his first overt act. He quitted his government in Ireland and landed unbidden in Wales. During the parliamentary session of the following year, a member of the Commons, one Young, boldly proposed that the Duke of York should be declared heir to the throne. This demand was formidable, not only for its backing, but for its good sense. The king had now been married for 6 years and had no child. The repute in which he stood made it seem unlikely that he would have any. Ought he not, men asked at this time, to designate his successor? If not York, whom then? It could only be Somerset or another representative of the Beaufort line. One can see how shrewdly this thrust was made. But the king, animated certainly by Margaret, repulsed it with unwonted vigour. He refused to abandon his hope of progeny, and as soon as the Parliament had dispersed, sent the presumptuous member to the Tower. At this time also he broke with the Duke of York, who retired to his castle at Ludlow on the borders of Wales. Disgusted by the government's failure to restore order and justice at home and to prevent military disasters in France, York became more and more convinced that the Beaufort party, which dominated the weak-willed king, must be driven from power. Prayers and protests had failed. There remained the resort to arms. Accordingly, on February 3, 1452, York sent an address to the citizens of Shrewsbury, accusing Somerset of the disgrace in France and of labouring continually about the King's Highness for my undoing, and to corrupt my blood, and to disinherit me and my heirs and such persons as be about me. Seeing that the said Duke ever prevaileth and ruleth about the king's person, and advises him so ill that the land is likely to be destroyed, I may full conclude to proceed in all haste against him with the help of my kinsmen and friends. On this, he marched from Shrewsbury towards London, with an army of several thousand men, including artillery. He moved into Kent, plainly expecting that those who had marched with Jack Cade would rally to his cause. The response was disappointing. London closed its gates against his emissaries. The king was carried by Margaret, Somerset, and the Lancastrian interests to Blackheath with a superior force. Civil war seemed about to begin. But York felt himself the weaker. He was constitutionally averse from violence. Norfolk was on his side, and other great nobles, but the Earl of Warwick, 24 years old, was with the king. Every effort was made to prevent bloodshed. Parleys were unending. In the event, York dispersed his forces and presented himself unarmed and bareheaded before King Henry, protesting his loyalty but demanding redress. His life hung by a thread. Few about the king's person would have scrupled to slay him. But all knew the consequences. York stood for a cause. He was supported by the commons. Half the nation was behind him. His youthful son, the Earl of March, had a second army on foot on the Welsh border. York declared himself the king's liegeman and servant. Since he was supported by the commons and evidently at the head of a great party, the king promised that a sad and substantial council should be formed, of which he should be a member. The court had still to choose between Somerset and York. The Queen, always working with Somerset, decided the issue in his favour. He was appointed Constable of Calais, garrisoned by the only regular troops in the pay of the Crown, and was, in fact, for more than a year at the head of affairs both in France and at home. Then, in quick succession, a series of grave events occurred. The disasters culminated in France. Talbot's attempt to reconquer Gascony failed. He was defeated at Castillon in July 1453, and Bordeaux fell in October. Somerset, the chief commander, bore the burden of defeat. In this situation, the king went mad. He'd gone down to Wiltshire to spend July and August. Suddenly his memory failed. He recognised no one, not even the queen. He could eat and drink, but his speech was childish or incoherent. He could not walk. For another 15 months he remained entirely without comprehension. Afterwards, when he recovered, he declared he remembered nothing. The pious Henry had been withdrawn from the worry of existence to an island of merciful oblivion. His body gaped and drivelled over the bristling realm. When these terrible facts became known, Queen Margaret aspired to be protector. But the adverse forces were too strong for the Lancastrian party to make the challenge. Moreover, she had another preoccupation. On October the 13th, she gave birth to a son. How far this event was expected is not clear, but as long afterwards, with James II, it inevitably hardened the hearts of all men. It seemed to shut out forever the Yorkist claim. Hitherto, neither side had been inclined to go to extremes. If Lancaster ruled during the life of Henry, York would succeed at his death, and both sides could accommodate themselves to this natural and lawful process. Now, it seemed, there would be a Lancastrian ascendancy forever. The insanity of the king defeated Somerset. He could no longer withstand York. Norfolk, one of York's supporters, presented a petition against him to the council, and in December 1453 he was committed to the Tower. The strength of York's position bore him to the Protectorate. He moved by parliamentary means and with great moderation, but he was not to be withstood. He obtained full control of the executive and enjoyed the support of both Houses of Parliament. He had not long to show his qualities, but an immediate improvement in the administration was recognised. He set to work with cool vigour to suppress livery and maintenance, and to restore order on the roads and throughout the land. He did not hesitate to imprison several of his own most prominent adherents, among them the Earl of Devonshire, for levying a private war. If he refrained from bringing Somerset, who was still imprisoned, to trial, this was only from mercy. His party were astounded at his tolerance. When the government was in his hands, when his future was marred by the new heir to the crown, when his power or his life might be destroyed at any moment by the king's recovery, he kept absolute faith with right and justice. Here, then, is his monument and justification. He stands before history as a patriot ready to risk his life to protect good government, but unwilling to raise his hand against the state in any personal interest. Surprises continued. When it was generally believed that Henry's line was extinct, he produced an heir. When he seemed to have sunk into permanent imbecility, he suddenly recovered. At Christmas 1454, he regained all his faculties. He inquired whether he'd been asleep and what had happened meanwhile. Margaret showed him his son and told him she'd named him Edward. Hitherto, he'd looked with dull eyes upon the infant. Every effort to rouse him had been in vain. Now he was as good as he had ever been. He held up his hands and thanked God, and, according to the Paston letters, he said he never knew till that time, nor wist not what was said to him, nor wist where he had been, why he had been sick, till now. He sent his almoner to Canterbury with a thank-offering, and declared himself in charity with all the world, remarking that he only wished the Lord's were, too. Chapter 6 The Wars of the Roses. In the spring of 1455, the Red Rose of Lancaster bloomed again. York ceased legally to be protector from the moment that the king's mental recovery was known. He made no effort to retain the power. Queen Margaret took the helm. Somerset was not only released, but restored to his key position. York's government of Calais, which had been conferred upon him for 7 years, was handed back to his rival. He was no longer invited to the King's Council Board, and when a great council of peers was convened at Leicester, he feared that he was summoned only to be tried. He retired to Sandal in Yorkshire, and, being joined by the Earls of Warwick and Salisbury, together with a large company of nobles strongly attended, he denounced Somerset as the man who, having lost Normandy and Guienne, was now about to ruin the whole kingdom. York's lords agreed upon a resort to arms. With 3,000 men they marched south. At the same time the Duke of Norfolk appeared at the head of several thousand Yorkists, and Shrewsbury and Sir Thomas Stanley of a few thousand more. All these forces moved towards London, with St. Albans as their point of concentration. The King, the Queen, Somerset, and the Court and Lancastrian party, with their power, which numbered less than 3,000 men, moved to Watford to meet them. St. Albans was an open town. The ancient, powerful monastery there had prevented the citizens from girding themselves about with a great wall, lest they should become presumptuous. For this reason, it was a convenient rendezvous. Here the King's army arrived, and the royal standard was unfurled in St. Peter's Street and Hollowell Street. York, Salisbury and Warwick did not wait for the heavy reinforcements that were approaching them. They saw that their forces had the advantage, and that hours counted. This time, there was a fight. It was a collision rather than a battle, but it was nonetheless decisive. Lord Clifford held for the King the barrier across the street, which York attacked with archery and cannon. But Warwick, circling the town, came in upon him from behind, slew him, and put the royal troops to flight. Somerset was killed, fighting for a cause which was more his own than the King's. The Duke of Buckingham and his son were wounded by arrows. Somerset's son, the Earl of Dorset, was captured, sorely wounded, and carried home in a cart. The King himself was slightly wounded by an arrow. He did not fly, but took refuge in a tradesman's house in the main street. There, presently, the Duke of York came to him, and, falling upon his knees, assured him of his fealty and devotion. No more than 300 men perished in this clash at St. Albans, but these included an extraordinary proportion of the nobles on the King's side. The rank and file were encouraged to spare one another. The leaders fought to the death. The bodies of Somerset and Clifford lay naked in the street for many hours, none daring to bury them. The Yorkist triumph was complete. They had now got the King in their hands. Somerset was dead. Margaret and her child had taken sanctuary. The victors declared their devotion to the royal person and rejoiced that he was rid of evil counsellors. Upon this, Parliament was immediately summoned in the King's name. Historians have shrunk from the Wars of the Roses, and most of those who have catalogued their events have left us only a melancholy and disjointed picture. We are, however, in the presence of the most ferocious and implacable quarrel of which there is factual record. The individual actors were bred by generations of privilege and war, into which the feudal theme had brought its peculiar sense of honour, and to which the papacy contributed such spiritual sanction as emerged from its rivalries and intrigues. It was a conflict in which personal hatreds reached their maximum, and from which mass effects were happily excluded. There must have been many similar convolutions in the human story. None, however, has been preserved with characters at once so worldly and so expensively chiselled. Needless causes of confusion may be avoided. Towns must not be confused with titles. The mortal struggle of York and Lancaster did not imply any antagonism between the two well-known English counties. York was in fact the stronghold of the Lancastrians, and the Yorkists founded their strength upon the Midlands and the south of England. The ups and downs of fortune were so numerous and startling, the family feud so complicated, the impact of national feeling in moments of crisis so difficult to measure, that it has been the fashion to disparage this period. Only Shakespeare, basing himself largely upon Hall's Chronicle, has portrayed its savage yet heroic lineaments. He does not attempt to draw conclusions, and for dramatic purposes, telescopes events and campaigns. Let us now set forth the facts as they occurred. St. Albans was the first shedding of blood in strife. The Yorkists gained possession of the king. But soon we see the inherent power of Lancaster. They had the majority of the nobles on their side and the majesty of the crown. In a few months they were as strong as ever. Continual trials of strength were made. There were risings in the country and grim assemblies of parliament. Legality, constitutionalism, and reverence for the crown were countered, but not yet overthrown, by turbulent and bloody episodes. The 4 years from 1456 to 1459 were a period of uneasy truce. All seemed conscious of the peril to themselves and to their order. But fate lay heavy upon them. There were intense efforts at reconciliation. The spectacle was displayed to the Londoners of the king being escorted to Westminster by a procession in which the Duke of York and Queen Margaret walked side by side, followed by the Yorkist and Lancastrian lords, the most opposed, in pairs. Solemn pledges of amity were exchanged. The sacrament was taken in common by all the leaders. All sought peace where there was no peace. Even when a kind of settlement was reached in London, it was upset by violence in the north. In 1459, fighting broke out again. A gathering near Worcester of armed Yorkists dispersed in the presence of the royal army, and their chiefs scattered. York returned to Ireland, and Warwick to his captaincy of Calais, in which he succeeded Somerset. War began in earnest in July 1460. York was still in Ireland, but the Yorkist lords under Warwick, holding bases in Wales and at Calais, with all their connections and partisans, supported by the papal legate and some of the bishops, and, on the whole, by the commons, confronted the Lancastrians and the crown at Northampton. Henry VI stood entrenched, and new cannon guarded his line. But when the Yorkists attacked, Lord Grey of Ruthven, who commanded a wing, deserted him and helped the Yorkists over the breastworks. The royal forces fled in panic. King Henry VI remained in his tent, sitting alone and solitary. The victors presented themselves to him, bowing to the ground. As, after St. Albans, they carried him again to London, and having him in their power once more, ruled in his name. The so-called compromise in which all the estates of the realm concurred was then attempted. The Duke of York, says Gregory's Chronicle, kept King Harry at Westminster by force and strength, till at last the king, for fear of death, granted him the crown. For a man that hath but little wit will soon be afeard of death. Henry was to be king for life. York was to conduct the government and succeed him at his death. All who sought a quiet life for the nation hailed this arrangement. But the settlement defied the fact that Queen Margaret, with her son, the Prince of Wales, was at liberty at Harlech Castle in Wales. The king, in bondage, had disinherited his own son. The queen fought on. With her army of the north and of North Wales, Margaret advanced to assert the birthright of her son. The Duke of York, disdaining to remain in the security of Sandal Castle until his whole strength was gathered, marched against her. At Wakefield, on December the 30th, 1460, the first considerable battle of the war was fought. The Lancastrians, with superior forces, caught the Yorkists by surprise when many were foraging, and a frightful rout and massacre ensued. Here there was no question of sparing the common men. Many hundreds were slaughtered. But the brunt fell upon the chiefs. No quarter was given. The Duke of York was killed. His son, the Earl of Rutland, 17 years old, was flying, but the new Lord Clifford, remembering St. Albans, slaughtered him with joy, exclaiming, "By God's blood, thy father slew mine, and so will I do thee and all thy kin." Henceforward, this was the rule of the war. The old Earl of Salisbury, caught during the night, was beheaded immediately by Lord Exeter, a natural son of the Duke of Buckingham. Margaret's hand has been discerned in this severity. The heads of the three Yorkist nobles were exposed over the gates and walls of York. The great Duke's head, with a paper crown, grinned upon the landscape, summoning the avengers. Hitherto the struggle had been between mature, comfortable magnates, deeply involved in state affairs and trying hard to preserve some limits. Now a new generation took charge. There was a new Lord Clifford, a new Duke of Somerset. Above all, a new Duke of York, all in their 20s, sword in hand, with fathers to avenge and England as the prize. When York's son, hitherto Earl of March, learned that his father's cause had devolved upon him, he did not shrink. He fell upon the Earl of Wiltshire and the Welsh Lancastrians, and on February the 2nd, 1461, at the Battle of Mortimer's Cross near Hereford, he beat and broke them up. He made haste to repay the cruelties of Wakefield. No quarter was again the word. Among those executed after the battle was Owen Tudor, a harmless notable who, with the axe and block before him, hardly believed that he would be beheaded until the collar of his red doublet was ripped off. His son, Jasper, lived, as will be seen, to carry on the quarrel. The victorious Yorkist under their young duke now marched to help the Earl of Warwick, who'd returned from Calais and was being hard-pressed in London. But Queen Margaret forestalled him, and on February the 17th, at the Second Battle of St. Albans, she inflicted upon Warwick a bloody defeat. Warwick, who was at this time the real leader of the Yorkist party, with many troops raised abroad and with the latest firearms and his own feudal forces, had carried the captive king with him and claimed to be acting in his name. But Margaret's onset took him by surprise. Their prickers, scouts, came not home to bring tidings how nigh the queen was, save one came and said that she was 9 mile off. Warwick and Norfolk escaped. Half their army was slaughtered. King Henry had been carted to the scene. There, beneath a large tree, he watched what happened with legitimate and presently unconcealed satisfaction. Two knights of high renown in the French war, one, the redoubtable Sir Thomas Kiriel, had been appointed as his warders and guardians. Above all, they were to make sure no harm came to him. They therefore remained with him under his tree, and all were surrounded by the victorious army. Among the many captains of consequence whom Margaret put to death in cold blood the next morning, these two cases needed special consideration. King Henry said he'd asked them to bide with him, and that they'd done so for his own safety. Queen Margaret produced her son Edward, now 7 years old, to whose disinheritance the king had perforce consented, and asked this child, already precociously fierce, to pronounce. "Fair son, with what death shall these two knights die whom you see there?" "Their heads should be cut off," was the ready answer. As Kiriel was being led away to his fate, he exclaimed, "May the wrath of God fall on those who have taught a child to speak such words." Thus was pity banished from all hearts, and death or vengeance was the cry. Margaret now had her husband safe back in her hands, and with him the full authority of the crown. The road to London was open, but she did not choose to advance upon it. The fierce horde she brought from the north had already disgraced themselves by their ravages far and wide along their line of march. They'd roused against them the fury of the countryside. The king's friends said, "They deemed that the northern men would have been too cruel in robbing if they'd come to London." The city was, upon the whole, steadfast in the Yorkist cause, but it was also said, if the king and queen had come with their army to London, they would have had all things as they wished. We cannot judge the circumstances fully. Edward of York was marching with the triumphant army of Mortimer's Cross, night and day, to reach London. Warwick had joined him in Oxfordshire with the survivors of St. Albans. Perhaps King Henry pleaded that the capital should not become a battlefield, but at any rate, Margaret and her advisers did not dare to make it so. Flushed with victory, laden with spoil, reunited with the king, the Lancastrians retired through Dunstable to the north, and thus disguised the fact that their Scottish mercenaries were already jogging home with all that they could carry. According to Holinshed, the Queen, having little trust in Essex, less in Kent, and least of all in London, departed from St. Albans into the North Country, where the foundations of her strength and refuge only rested. This was the turning point in the struggle. 9 days after the Second Battle of St. Albans, Edward of York entered London. The citizens, who might have submitted to Margaret and the king, now hailed the Yorkists with enthusiasm. They thanked God and said, "Let us walk in a new vineyard, and let us make a gay garden in the month of March with this fair white rose and herb, the Earl of March." It was a vineyard amid thorns. The pretense of acting in the king's name could serve no longer. The Yorkists had become, without disguise, traitors and rebels against the crown. But the mood of the youthful warrior who had triumphed and butchered at Mortimer's Cross recked little of this charge. As he saw it, his father had been ruined and killed through respect for the majesty of Henry the Sixth. He and his friends would palter no longer with such conceptions. Forthwith, he claimed the crown, and such was the feeling of London, and the strength of his army, now upon the spot, that he was able to make good show of public authority for his act. He declared himself king, and on March the 4th, 1461, was proclaimed at Westminster with such formalities as were possible. Henceforward he declared that the other side were guilty of treason, and that he would enforce upon them every penalty. These assertions must now be made good, and King Edward the 4th marched north to settle once and for all with King Henry the 6th. Near York, the Queen, with the whole power of Lancaster, confronted him not far from Tadcaster, by the villages of Saxton and Towton. Some accounts declare that 100,000 men were on the field, the Yorkists having 40, and the Lancastrians 60,000. But later authorities greatly reduced these figures. On March the 28th, the Yorkist advance guard was beaten back at Ferry Bridge by the young Lord Clifford, and Warwick himself was wounded. But as heavier forces arrived, the bridge was carried. Clifford was slain, and the Yorkist army passed over. The next day, one of the most ruthless battles on English soil was fought. The Lancastrians held a good position on rising ground, their right flank being protected by the flooded stream of the Cock, in many places unfordable. Although Edward's army was not complete, and the Duke of Norfolk's wing was still approaching, he resolved to attack. The battle began in a blinding snowstorm, which drove in the faces of the Lancastrians. Under this cover, clumps of Yorkist spearmen moved up the slope. The wind gave superior range to the archery of the attack, and the Lancastrian shafts fell short, while they themselves suffered heavily. Under this pressure, the decision was taken to advance downhill upon the foe. For 6 hours the two sides grappled furiously, with varying success. At the height of the battle, Warwick is said to have dismounted and slain his horse, to prove to his men he would not quit them alive. But all hung in the balance until late in the afternoon, when the arrival of the Duke of Norfolk's corps, upon the exposed flank of the Lancastrians, drove the whole mass into retreat, which soon became a rout. Now the Cock Beck, hitherto a friend to Lancaster, became an enemy. The bridge towards Tadcaster was blocked with fugitives. Many thousands of men, heavily armoured, plunged into the swollen stream, and were drowned in such numbers that hideous bridges were formed of the corpses, and some escaped thereby. The pursuit was carried on far into the night. Margaret and her son escaped to York, where King Henry had been observing the rites of Palm Sunday. Gathering him up, the imperious queen set out with her child and a cluster of spears for the Scottish border. The bodies of thousands of Englishmen lay upon the field. Edward, writing to his mother, conceals his own losses, but claims that 28,000 Lancastrian dead had been counted. It is certain that the flower of the Lancastrian nobility and knighthood fell upon the field. For all prisoners, there was but death. The Earl of Devonshire and the bastard of Exeter alone were spared, and only for a day. When Edward reached the town of York, his first task was to remove the heads of his father and others of Margaret's victims, and to replace them with those of his noblest captives. 3 months later, on June the 28th, he was crowned king at Westminster, and the Yorkist triumph seemed complete. It was followed by wholesale proscriptions and confiscations. Parliament, in November 1461, passed an act of attainder which, surpassing all previous severities, lapped 133 notable persons in its withering sweep. Not only the throne, but one-third of the estates in England changed hands. It was measure for measure. After Towton, the Lancastrian cause was sustained by the unconquerable will of Queen Margaret. Never has her tenacity, and rarely have her vicissitudes been surpassed in any woman. Apart from the sullen power of Lancaster in the north, she had the friendly regard of two countries, Scotland and France. Both had felt the heavy arm of England in former reigns, both rejoiced at its present division and weakness. The hatred of the Scots for the English still excited by its bitterness the wonder of foreigners. When Louis XI succeeded his father, Charles VII, in 1461, the year of Towton, he found his own country almost a desert, horrible to see. The fields were untilled, the villages were clusters of ruined hovels. Amid the ruins, the weeds and brushwood, to use a term which recurs, of what were formerly cultivated and fertile fields, there dwelt a race of peasants reduced to the conditions and roused to the ferocity of wolves. All this was the result of the English invasion. Therefore, it was a prime aim of Scottish and French policy, always moving hand in hand, to foster the internal strife of England and to sustain the weaker party there. Margaret, as Queen of England and Princess of France, was an outstanding personage in the west of Europe. Her qualities of courage and combativeness, her commanding, persuasive personality, her fury against those who'd driven her and her husband from the throne, produced from this one woman's willpower a long series of desperate, forlorn struggles after the main event had been decided, and after the lapse of years, for one brief spell, reversed it. English national interests did not enter her mind. She paid her way with Scotland by the surrender of Berwick. She clinched her bargain with Louis XI by mortgaging Calais to him for 20,000 gold livres. In 1462, Margaret, after much personal appeal to the courts of France, Burgundy and Scotland, found herself able to land with a power, and whether by treachery or weakness, the three strongest northern castles, Bamburgh, Alnwick and Dunstanburgh, opened their gates to her. Louis XI had lent her the services of a fine soldier, Pierre de Brézé, who under her spell spent his large fortune in her cause. In the winter of 1462, therefore, King Edward gathered his Yorkist powers, and carrying his new train of artillery by sea to Newcastle, began the sieges of these lost strongholds. The king himself lay stricken with measles at Durham, and Lord Warwick conducted the operations. The heavy cannon, each with its pet name, played havoc with the masonry of the castles. So vigorously were the sieges conducted that even Christmas leave was forbidden. Margaret, from Berwick, in vain attempted the relief of Alnwick. All three fortresses fell in a month. The behaviour of Edward at this moment constitutes a solid defence of his character. This voluptuous young king, sure of his position, now showed a clemency unheard of in the Wars of the Roses. Not only did he pardon the Lancastrian nobles who were caught in the fortresses, but he made solemn pacts with them and took them into his full confidence. The Duke of Somerset and Sir Ralph Percy, on swearing allegiance, were not merely allowed to go free, but restored to their estates. Percy was even given the guardianship of two of the castles. Somerset, son of the eminent minister slaughtered in the First Battle of St. Albans, was admitted to even higher favour. Having made his peace, he was given a high command and a place in the inner councils of the royal army. In this new position, at first he gave shrewd military advice and was granted special pensions by the king. Edward's magnanimity and forgiveness were ill repaid. When Margaret returned with fresh succours from France and Scotland in 1463, Percy opened the gates of Bamburgh to the Scots, and Alnwick was betrayed about the same time by a soured Yorkist officer, Sir Ralph Grey. Meanwhile, Queen Margaret, with King Henry in her hands, herself besieged the castle of Norham, on the Tweed near Berwick. Once again, Edward and the Yorkists took to the field, and the redoubtable new artillery, at that time esteemed as much among the leading nations as atomic weapons are today, was carried to the north. The great guns blew chunks off the castles. Margaret fled to France, while Henry buried himself amid the valleys and the pious foundations of Cumberland. This was the final parting of King Henry VI and his queen. Queen she was. Margaret took the prince with her on her travels. These were remarkable. With the Duke of Exeter, six knights, and her faithful Pierre de Brézé, she landed at Sluis and appealed to the renowned chivalry of the House of Burgundy. She came without royal habit or estate. She and her seven waiting women had only the clothes they were wearing. Brézé paid for their food. Nevertheless, she was treated even in this adverse court with royal honours. Philip, Duke of Burgundy, was aged. His son Charles was surnamed the Bold. The ambassadors of England were active. Margaret got nothing from Burgundy except the gifts and courtesies which old-time hospitality would afford to a dame in distress. It is, however, from these contacts that our knowledge of Margaret's adventures is derived. Chastelain, the Burgundian chronicler, recorded her tales. Thus only has history heard how she, King Henry and her son, had lived for 5 days without bread, upon a herring each day between them. At Mass once, the Queen found herself without even a penny for the offertory. She asked a Scottish archer nearby to lend her something. Somewhat stiffly and regretfully, he drew a groat from his purse. At the latest disaster at Norham, recounted the Queen, she'd been captured by plundering Yorkist soldiers, robbed, and brought before the captain to be beheaded. Only a quarrel of her captors over the spoil delayed her execution. But there stood a Yorkist squire, and to him she turned, speaking pitifully. "Madam," he said, "mount behind me, and Monseigneur the Prince in front, and I will save you or die, seeing that death is more likely to come to me than not." Three aback, they plunged into the forest, Margaret in terror for her son's life, on which her cause depended. The Yorkist squire now rode off. The forest was a known haunt of bandits, and mother and son crouched in its recesses. Soon there appeared a man of hideous and horrible aspect, with obvious intention to kill and rob. But once more Margaret, by her personal force, prevailed. She said who she was, and confided her son, the heir to the throne, to the brigand's honour. The robber was faithful to his charge. The Queen and the Prince at last both reached the shelter of the fugitive king. Edward's clemency had been betrayed by Percy, but he did not withdraw his confidence from Somerset. The king was a man capable of the most bloody deeds when compelled, as he thought, by necessity, and at the same time eager to practice not only magnanimity, but open-hearted confidence. The confidence he showed to Somerset must have led him into deadly perils. This third duke was, during the beginning of 1463, high in the king's favour. And the king made full much of him, insomuch he lodged with the king in his own bed many nights, and sometimes rode a-hunting behind the king. The king having about him not passing 6 horse at the most, and yet 3 were of the Duke's men of Somerset. When in the autumn of 1463 he went to the north, Somerset and 200 of his own men were his bodyguard. At Northampton, where bitter memories of the battle lingered, the townsfolk were first astounded and then infuriated to see this bearer of an accursed name in company with their Yorkist sovereign. Only King Edward's personal exertions saved his new-found follower from being torn to pieces. After this, he found it necessary to provide other employment for Somerset and his escort. Somerset was sent to Holt Castle in Denbighshire. The brawl at Northampton, we must suppose, convinced him that even the king could not protect him from his Yorkist foes. At Christmas, 1463, Somerset deserted Edward and returned to the Lancastrian side. The names of these great nobles were magnets in their own territories. The unstable duke had hoped to gain possession of Newcastle, and many of his adherents, on the report that he was in the neighbourhood, came out to him. But he was driven away, and they were caught and beheaded. Again the banner of Lancaster was raised. Somerset joined King Henry. Alnwick and Bamborough still held out. Norham and Skipton had been captured, but now Warwick's brother Montague, with a substantial army, was in the field. On April the 25th, 1464, at Hedgeley Moor near Alnwick, he broke and destroyed the Lancastrian revolt. The leaders perished on the field or afterwards on the block. Sir Ralph Percy fought to the death and used the expression, remarkable for one who'd accepted pardon and even office from King Edward, "I have saved the bird in my bosom." What was this bird? It was the cause of Lancaster, which might be dissembled or even betrayed under duress, but still remained, when occasion served, the lodestar of its adherents. There were many who had this bird in their bosoms, but could never have coined Percy's grand phrase, or stooped to his baseness. Edward's experiment of mercy in this quarrel was now at an end, and the former rigours were renewed in their extreme degree. Somerset, defeated with a small following at Hexham on May the 15th, 1464, was beheaded the next morning. Before the month was out, in every Yorkist camp, Lancastrian nobles and knights by dozens and half-dozens were put to death. There was nothing for it but to still these unquiet spirits. John Tiptoft, Earl of Worcester, Constable of England, versed in the civil law and with Italian experience, presided over Drumhead courts-martial, and by adding needless cruelties to his severities, justified a vengeance one day to be exacted. Meanwhile, the diplomacy of the English crown had effected a 15 years' truce with the King of Scotland, and was potent both at the courts of France and Burgundy. Margaret remained helpless at Bar-le-Duc. Poor King Henry was at length tracked down near Clitheroe in Lancashire and conveyed to London. This time there was no ceremonial entry. With his feet tied by leather thongs to the stirrups, and with a straw hat on his head, the futile but saintly figure around whom such storms had beaten was led 3 times round the pillory, and finally hustled to the Tower, whose gates closed on him, yet not, this time, for ever. With the fall of Alnwick, only one fortress in the whole kingdom still resisted. The castle of Harlech on the western sea alone flaunted the red rose. Harlech stood a siege of 7 years. When it surrendered in 1468, there were found to be but 50 effective men in the garrison. With 2 exceptions, they were admitted to mercy. Among them was a child of 12 who'd survived the rigours of the long blockade. He was the nephew of Jasper, the grandson of Owen Tudor, and the future founder of the Tudor dynasty and system of government. His name was Richmond, later to become King Henry the Seventh. Chapter 7. The Adventures of Edward the Fourth. King Edward the Fourth had made good his right to the crown upon the field. He was a soldier and a man of action. In the teeth of danger, his quality was at its highest. In war, nothing daunted or wearied him. Long marches, hazardous decisions, the marshalling of armies, the conduct of battles, seemed his natural sphere. The worse things got, the better he became. But the opposite was also true. He was at this time a fighting man and little more, and when the fighting stopped, he had no serious zest for sovereignty. The land was fair, the blood of youth coursed in his veins, all his blood debts were paid. With ease and goodwill, he sheathed his sharp sword. It had won him his crown. Now, to enjoy life. The successes of these difficult years had been gained for King Edward by the Neville family. Warwick and Montague, now Earl of Northumberland, with George Neville, Archbishop of York, had the whole machinery of government in their hands. The king had been present only at some of the actions. He could even be reproached for his misguided clemency, which had opened up again the distresses of civil war. His magnanimity had been at length sternly repressed by his counsellors and generals. In the first part of his reign, England was therefore ruled by the two brothers, Warwick and Northumberland. They believed they'd put the king on the throne and meant him to remain there while they governed. The king did not quarrel with this. In all his reign, he never fought but when he was forced. Then he was magnificent. History has scolded this prince of 22 for not possessing immediately the statecraft and addiction to business for which his office called. Edward united contrasting characters. He loved peace, he shone in war. But he loved peace for its indulgences rather than its dignity. His pursuit of women, in which he found no obstacles, combined with hunting, feasting, and drinking to fill his life. Were these not the rightful prizes of victory? Let Warwick and Northumberland and other anxious lords carry the burden of state, and let the king be merry. For a while this suited all parties. The victors divided the spoil. The king had his amusements, and his lords their power and policy. Thus some years slipped by, while the king, although gripping from time to time the reins of authority, led in the main his life of ease. His mood towards men and women is described in well-chosen words by the staid Hume. During the present interval of peace, he lived in the most familiar and sociable manner with his subjects, particularly with the Londoners. And the beauty of his person, as well as the gallantry of his address, which, even unassisted by his royal dignity, would have rendered him acceptable to the fair, facilitated all his applications for their favour. This easy and pleasurable course of life augmented every day his popularity among all ranks of men. He was the peculiar favourite of the young and gay of both sexes. The disposition of the English, little addicted to jealousy, kept them from taking umbrage at these liberties. And his indulgence in amusements, while it gratified his inclination, was thus become, without design, a means of supporting and securing his government. After these comparatively mild censures, the historian proceeds to deplore the weakness and imprudence which led the king to stray from the broad, sunlit glades of royal libertinage onto the perilous precipices of romance and marriage. One day, the king, a-hunting, was carried far by the chase. He rested for the night at a castle. In this castle, a lady of quality, niece of the owner, had found shelter. Elizabeth Woodville, or Widville, was the widow of a Lancastrian knight, Sir John Grey, in Margaret's battle at St. Albans, slain. Her mother, Jacquetta of Luxembourg, had been the youthful wife of the famous John, Duke of Bedford, and after his death she'd married his steward, Sir Richard Woodville, later created Earl Rivers. This condescension, so far below her station, caused offence to the aristocracy. She was fined £1,000 as a deterrent to others. Nevertheless, she lived happily ever after, and bore her husband no fewer than 13 children, of whom Elizabeth was one. There was high as well as ordinary blood in Elizabeth's veins. She was an austere woman, upright, fearless, chaste, and fruitful. She and her two sons were all under the ban of attainder, which disinherited the adherents of Lancaster. The chance of obtaining royal mercy could not be missed. The widow bowed in humble petition before the youthful conqueror, and, like the tanner's daughter, Falaise, made at first glance the sovereign her slave. Shakespeare's account, though somewhat crude, does not err in substance. The Lady Elizabeth observed the strictest self-restraint, which only enhanced the passion of the king. He gave her all his love, and when he found her obdurate, he besought her to share his crown. He spurned the counsels of prudence and worldly wisdom. Why conquer in battles? Why be a king, if not to gain one's heart's desire? But he was well aware of the dangers of his choice. His marriage in 1464 with Elizabeth Woodville was a secret, guarded in deadly earnest. The statesmen at the head of the government, while they smiled at what seemed an amorous frolic, never dreamed it was a solemn union, which must shake the land to its depths. Warwick's plans for the king's future had been different. Isabella of the House of Spain, or preferably a French princess, were brides who might greatly forward the interests of England. A royal marriage in those days might be a bond of peace between neighbouring states, or the means of successful war. Warwick used grave arguments and pressed the king to decide. Edward seemed strangely hesitant and dwelt upon his objections until the minister, who was also his master, became impatient. Then at last the truth was revealed to all. He had, for 5 months, been married to Elizabeth Woodville. Here, then, was the occasion which sundered him from the valiant kingmaker, 14 years older, but also in the prime of life. Warwick had deep roots in England, and his popularity, whetted by the lavish hospitality which he offered to all classes upon his many great estates, was unbounded. The Londoners looked to him. He held the power. But no one knew better than he that there slept in Edward a tremendous warrior, skilful, ruthless, and capable, when roused, of attempting and of doing all. The king, too, for his part, began to take more interest in affairs. Queen Elizabeth had 5 brothers, 7 sisters, and 2 sons. By royal decree, he raised them to high rank, or married them into the greatest families. He went so far as to marry his wife's 4th brother, at 20, to the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk, aged 80. 8 new peerages came to existence in the Queen's family: her father, 5 brothers-in-law, her son, and her brother Anthony. This was generally thought excessive. It must be remembered that at this time there were but 60 peers, of whom not more than 50 could ever be got to Parliament on one occasion. All these potentates were held in a tight and nicely calculated system. The arrival of a new nobility, who'd done nothing notable in the war, and now surrounded the indolent king, was not merely offensive, but politically dangerous to Warwick and his proud associates. But the clash came over foreign policy. In this sad generation, England, lately the master, had become the sport of neighbouring states. Her titled refugees, from one faction or the other, beset the courts of Western Europe. The Duke of Burgundy had been shocked to learn one morning that a Duke of Exeter and several other high English nobles were actually begging their bread at the tail of one of his progresses. Ashamed to see such a slight upon his class, he provided them with modest dwellings and allowances. Similar charities were performed by Louis XI to the unhappy descendants of the victors of Agincourt. Margaret, with her retinue of shadows, was welcomed in her pauper stateliness both in Burgundy and in France. At any moment, either power, now become formidable as England had waned, might support the exiled faction in good earnest and pay back the debts of 50 years before by an invasion of England. It was the policy of Warwick and his connection to make friends with France, by far the stronger power, and thus obtain effectual security. In this mood, they hoped to make a French match for the king's sister. Edward took the opposite line. With the instinct which afterwards ruled our island for so many centuries, he sought to base English policy upon the second strongest state in Western Europe. He could no doubt argue that to be the ally of France was to be in the power of France, but to be joined with Burgundy was to have the means of correcting, if not controlling, French action. Amid his revelries and other hunting, he nursed a conqueror's spirit. Never should England become a vassal state. Instead of being divided by her neighbours, she would herself, by dividing them, maintain a balance. At this time, these politics were new, but the stresses they wrought in the small but vehement world of English government can be readily understood nowadays. The king, therefore, to Warwick's chagrin and alarm, in 1468 married his sister Margaret to Charles the Bold, who had, in 1467, succeeded as Duke of Burgundy. Thus, not only did these great lords, who, at the constant peril of their lives and by all their vast resources, had placed him on the throne, suffer slights and material losses by the creation of a new nobility, but they had besides to stomach a foreign policy which they believed would be fatal to England, to the Yorkist party, and to themselves. What help could Burgundy give if France, joined to the House of Lancaster, invaded England? What would happen to them, their great estates, and all who depended upon them in such a catastrophe? The quarrel between the King and Warwick as head of the Nevilles was not therefore petty, or even, as has often been suggested, entirely personal. The offended chiefs took deep counsel together. Edward continued to enjoy his life with his queen, and now and again with others. His attention in public matters was occupied mainly with Lancastrian plots and movements, but underneath and behind him a far graver menace was preparing. The Nevilles were at length ready to try conclusions with him. Warwick's plan was singular in its skill. He had gained the king's brother, Clarence, to his side by whispering that, but for this upstart brood of the Woodvilles, he might succeed Edward as king. As bond, it was secretly agreed that Clarence should marry Warwick's daughter, Isabella. When all was ready, Warwick struck. A rising took place in the north. Thousands of men in Yorkshire, under the leadership of various young lords, complained in arms about taxation. The thrave, a levy paid since the days of Athelstan, became suddenly obnoxious. But other grievances were urged, particularly that the king was swayed by favourites. At the same time in London, the House of Commons petitioned against lax and profuse administration. The king was now forced to go to the north. Except his small bodyguard, he had no troops of his own, but he called upon his nobles to bring out their men. He advanced in July to Nottingham, and there awaited the earls of Pembroke and Devon, both new creations of his own, who'd marshalled the levies of Wales and the West. As soon as the king had been enticed northwards by the rebellion, Warwick and Clarence, who had hitherto crouched at Calais, came to England with a Calais garrison. Warwick published a manifesto supporting the northern rebels, the king's true subjects, as he termed them, and urged them, with piteous lamentations, to be the means to our sovereign lord the king of remedy and reformation. Warwick was joined by many thousands of Kentish men, and was received with great respect in London. But before he and Clarence could bring their forces against the king's rear, the event was decided. The northern rebels, under Robin of Reedsdale, intercepted Pembroke and Devon, and at Edgecote, near Banbury, defeated them with a merciless slaughter, 168 knights, squires, and gentlemen either falling in the fight or being executed thereafter. Both Pembroke and later Devon were beheaded. The king, trying to rally his scattered forces at Olney in Buckinghamshire, found himself in the power of his great nobles. His brother, Richard of Gloucester, known to legend as Crookback because of his alleged deformity, seemed his only friend. At first he attempted to rally Warwick and Clarence to their duty, but in the course of conversation he was made to realise that he was their captive. With bows and ceremonies they explained that his future reign must be in accordance with their advice. He was conveyed to Warwick's castle at Middleham, and there kept in honourable but real restraint under the surveillance of the Archbishop of York. At this moment, therefore, Warwick the Kingmaker had actually the two rival kings, Henry the Sixth and Edward the Fourth, both his prisoners, one in the Tower and the other at Middleham. This was a remarkable achievement for any subject. To make the lesson even plainer, Lord Rivers, the Queen's father, and John Woodville, her brother, were arrested and executed at Kenilworth without any pretense of trial. Thus did the older nobility deal with the new. But the relations between Warwick and the king did not admit of such simple solutions. Warwick had struck with suddenness, and for a while no one realised what had happened. As the truth became known, the Yorkist nobility viewed with astonishment and anger the detention of their brave, victorious sovereign, and the Lancastrians everywhere raised their heads in the hopes of profiting by the Yorkist feud. The king found it convenient in his turn to dissemble. He professed himself convinced that Warwick and Clarence were right. He undertook to amend his ways, and after he'd signed free pardons to all who'd been in arms against him, he was liberated. Thus was a settlement reached between Warwick and the Crown. King Edward was soon again at the head of forces, defeating Lancastrian rebels and executing their leaders, while Warwick and all his powerful connections returned to their posts, proclaimed their allegiance, and apparently enjoyed royal favour. But all this was on the surface. In March 1470, under the pretense of suppressing a Lancastrian rebellion in Lincolnshire, the king called his forces to arms. At Luscott Field, he defeated the insurgents, who fled. And in the series of executions, which had now become customary after every engagement, he obtained a confession from Sir Robert Wells, which accused both Warwick and Clarence of treason. The evidence is fairly convincing, for at this moment they were conspiring against Edward, and shortly afterwards refused to obey his express order to join them. The king, with troops fresh from victory, turned on them all of a sudden. He marched against them, and they fled, astounded that their own methods should be retorted upon themselves. They sought safety in Warwick's base at Calais, but Lord Wenlock, whom he'd left as his deputy, refused to admit them. Even after they'd bombarded the seafront, he made it a positive favour to send a few flagons of wine to Clarence's bride, who, on board ship, had just given birth to a son. The kingmaker found himself, by one sharp twist of fortune, deprived of almost every resource he'd counted upon as sure. He, in his turn, presented himself at the French court as a suppliant. But this was the best luck Louis XI had ever known. He must have rubbed his hands in the same glee as when he visited his former minister, Cardinal Jean Balue, whom he kept imprisoned in an iron cage at Chinon because he'd conspired with Charles the Bold. 2 years earlier, Edward, as the ally of Burgundy, had threatened him with war. Now, here in France, were the leaders of both the parties that had disputed England for so long. Margaret was dwelling in her father's Anjou. Warwick, friend of France, vanquished in his own country, had arrived at Honfleur. With gusto, the stern, cynical, hard-pressed Louis set himself to the task of reconciling and combining these opposite forces. At Angers, he confronted Margaret and her son, now a fine youth of 17, with Warwick and Clarence, and proposed brutally to them that they should join together with his support to overthrow Edward. At first, both parties recoiled. Nor can we wonder. A river of blood had flowed between them. All that they had fought for during these cruel years was defaced by their union. Warwick and Margaret had slain with deliberation each other's dearest friends and kin. She'd beheaded his father, Salisbury, slain his uncle, York, and his cousin, Rutland. He, for his part, had butchered the two Somersets, father and son, the Earl of Wiltshire, and many of her devoted adherents. The common people who'd fallen in their quarrel, they were uncounted. In 1459, Margaret had declared Warwick attainted, a terrible outlawry. In 1460, he'd branded her son as bastard or changeling. They'd done each other the gravest human injuries, but they had one bond in common. They hated Edward, and they wanted to win. They were the champions of a generation which could not accept defeat, and here, as indeed for a time it proved, appeared the means of speedy triumph. Warwick had a fleet commanded by his nephew, the bastard of Fauconberg. He had the sailors in all the seaports of the south coast. He knew he had but to go, or send his summons to large parts of England, for the people to take arms at his command. Margaret represented the beaten, disinherited, proscribed House of Lancaster, stubborn as ever. They agreed to forgive and unite. They took solemn oaths at Angers upon a fragment of the Holy Cross, which, luckily, was available. The Confederacy was sealed by the betrothal of Margaret's son, the Prince of Wales, to Warwick's younger daughter, Anne. No one can blame Queen Margaret, because in the ruin of her cause, she reluctantly forgave injuries and welcomed the kingmaker's invaluable help. She'd never swerved from her faith. But for Warwick, the transaction was unnatural, cynical, and brutal. Moreover, he overlooked the effect on Clarence of the new marriage he'd arranged for his daughter Anne. A son born of this union would have had a great hope of uniting torn, tormented England. It was reasonable to expect the birth of an heir to these prospects. But Clarence had been swayed in his desertion of his brother by thoughts of the crown, and although he was now named as the next in succession after Margaret's son, the value of his chance was no longer high. Edward had been staggered by his brother's conduct. He did not, however, allow his personal resentment to influence his action. A lady in attendance upon the new Duchess of Clarence proved to be a discreet and accomplished emissary of the king. She conveyed to Clarence, soon after he fled from England, that he had only to rejoin his brother for all to be pardoned and forgotten. The new agreement between Warwick and Margaret decided Clarence to avail himself of this fraternal offer, but not immediately. He must have been a great dissembler, for Warwick was no more able to forecast his actions in the future than his brother had been in the past. King Edward was by now alarmed and vigilant, but he could scarcely foresee how many of his supporters would betray him. Warwick repeated the process he'd used a year before. Fitzhugh, his cousin, started a new insurrection in Yorkshire. Edward gathered some forces and, making little of the affair, marched against the rebels. Warned by Charles of Burgundy, he even expressed his wish that Warwick would land. He seems to have been entirely confident. But never was there a more swift undeception. Warwick and Clarence landed at Dartmouth in September 1470. Kent and other southern counties rose in his behalf. Warwick marched to London. He brought the miserable Henry VI from his prison in the Tower, placed a crown on his head, paraded him through the capital, and seated him upon the throne. At Nottingham, Edward received alarming news. The major part of his kingdom seemed to have turned against him. Suddenly he learned that while the northern rebels were moving down upon him and cutting him from his Welsh succours, and while Warwick was moving northward with strong forces, the Marquess of Montague, Warwick's brother, hitherto faithful, had made his men throw up their caps for King Henry. When Edward heard of Montague's desertion, and also of rapid movements to secure his person, he deemed it his sole hope to fly beyond the seas. He had but one refuge, the court of Burgundy, and with a handful of followers he cast himself upon his brother-in-law. Charles the Bold was also cautious. He had to consider the imminent danger of an attack by England and France united. Until he was sure that this was inevitable, he temporized with his royal refugee relation. But when it became clear that the policy of Warwick was undoubtedly to make war upon him in conjunction with Louis XI, he defended himself by an obvious manoeuvre. He furnished King Edward with about 1,200 trustworthy Flemish and German soldiers and the necessary ships and money for a descent. These forces were collected secretly in the island of Walcheren. Meanwhile, the kingmaker ruled in England, and it seemed that he might long continue to do so. He had King Henry VI's a puppet in his hand. The unhappy man, a breathing ruin sitting like a sack upon the throne, with a crown on his head and a scepter in his hand, received the